This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 82. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it, I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How's it going this week?
You know, it's good. I've been in and out of town this week, and I'm trying to wrap up a pretty big Hittail feature I've been working on for a while. It's an integration that allows me to basically have one-click articles created for keyword suggestions so that people can, because that's kind of the one biggest complaint people have, or the one biggest reason people cancel, is that they get all these suggestions, but it basically creates work for them, and customers will be able to click one link, wait a couple days, and then get an article back for the keyword.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. It's been on my list for months, since like before I relaunched, you know, and so I finally just took the fall this week. And it's one of those things that's been both easier and harder than I thought it would be. You know, certain parts have just flown by, and other parts that you would think would just work have taken, you know, 12 hours or something. So
like estimating code.
Oh my gosh. No, not that actually. It's the connecting to an API thing that should just work. It's a SOAP API, and .NET is supposed to work just great with SOAP. And yet this SOAP API doesn't.
I was referring more to the fact that when you're trying to estimate how long something's going to take in code, like sometimes you're just off by orders of magnitude.
A bazillion. Yeah, right. Because you run into one thing that should just work, that should be one line of code, and instead you have to write like an entire class library to handle it from scratch. I've had to go down to bare metal and basically call SOAP using XML strings.
Oh.
And yeah, exactly. And HTTP posts and responses and parsing and that, because the kind of SOAP they're using on their end isn't working with the class libraries that are available. So yeah, it's been interesting. It's times like this, I'm glad I'm a developer, because I'm able to just suck it up and do it. Because I would hate to, if I had, you know, like a hired developer, it'd be a struggle, because I bet they'd be running into all kinds of problems. And it's kind of hard to communicate. If you're a developer trying to communicate and saying, this just isn't working, and, you know, what should I do? Should I just press through or spend an extra 12 hours to do it? Whereas I just got to the point where it's like, yeah, I just need to spend the time. And
I think it'd be especially hard if you weren't a developer, because then it'd be hard to articulate what some of the problems are if you were to try to hand it off to somebody else.
Exactly. Like, why is this taking 12 times longer than I thought it would? You know, because I thought that all the SOAP connection would take less than an hour, because you just do the reference and you get, you know, the whole object structure built for you automatically. And when that didn't work, it's like, okay, I'll just spend this time parsing little XML in and out. So
cool. You know, I think I mentioned last week that I would be doing a couple of surveys. One was the MicroConf survey, and so we'll talk a little bit about that. And then I did another survey for Audit Shark. But let's talk about the MicroConf survey first. I mean, we sent out a survey to all the MicroConf attendees and got some pretty interesting data points back.
Yeah, I was quite pleased, because it's like, you know, you're at the conference and you're asking people's opinions, but it's hard to get a real good gauge, because you can only ask 20 people or so, and so it's, you can't really get a representative sample. And this year we made this survey a lot shorter, so I think we got a good response. We got a great response last year as well, but yeah, some of the key insights I guess of the respondents, 80% were first-timers, first-time MicroConfers, and then 20% were had been there last year. The breakdown of mobile, web, and desktop, people could select more than one, because obviously some people are doing both web and desktop, but it was 85% web, 51% mobile, and 38% desktop. So that does indicate, I mean, we got some feedback that we need to provide kind of more mobile stuff, and I agree, we definitely need a mobile speaker next year. Then in terms of, we had a mobile app that you can install on Android and iPhone, and it was like the schedule and info about the conference. And that was through kitapps.com. They sponsored it and gave it to us for free, which was cool. It turns out 47% of attendees liked it, 25% didn't find it useful, around 28% did not install it.
Mm-hmm. So of the people who liked it, though, I mean, that basically comes out and says about 67% of the people who used it liked it.
Exactly.
And I remember talking to some people about it, and they said, yeah, I didn't really like it because, you know, it'd be really nice to have specific timelines for, you know, when the speakers are talking and what's going on throughout the course of that 9-to-5 block. And they said, you should really put in the actual times that everybody's speaking. And I told them, I was like, well, we did that last year, and 10 minutes into the conference, the whole schedule went sideways. And then we were trying to play catch up and everything was off. So there was no point to even doing that. And same thing happened this year. I mean, 10 minutes into the conference, I mean, we were already 15, 20 minutes off schedule. So it didn't help. I think that it probably would have made things a lot more chaotic.
Yeah, I agree. Several conferences I've attended in this last year don't have specific time schedules. They just have speaker orders and they have the expectation that you'll get a break between each speaker. And I'm pretty sure that's how we're going to continue to do it, because you're right, having this tight schedule that you can't stick to because of unforeseen stuff. And we had a speaker drop out last year. We had speakers swapping like the night before, wanting to go on a different day this time due to health issues. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that is just out of your control. The cool part, we got feedback on the speakers and all that, but the cool part is we left some open-ended questions of like, what are the three things you like the most? And what are the three things that you like the least, or that we should try to improve upon? And some of the suggestions or some of the thoughts about the three things people like the most were same things we heard last year, so which is good. It means we're being consistent, but it was the quality of the attendees and the small size of the conference. And so people were saying, you need to keep the price where it is or raise it. You need to keep this group tight, and you need to keep the people who are coming here, they need to be serious, because people would, even in this survey, people were giving examples about like they went to a different conference last week and it just had a bunch of people who kind of were wasting the time of other attendees, and it wasn't even fun to walk around and talk to people because they didn't have anything in common. So that's cool. Like, keeping that quality of attendee and the seriousness high, I think has been a real kind of boon for us over the past 2 years.
Interestingly enough, I think that last year we had gotten some, I think it was early on, we got some initial complaints about the cost of the conference. And I think that cost actually keeps those types of people out who aren't very serious about it.
Exactly. Oh, the approachability of the speakers. And that's, again, something we heard last year was, since we've kept it relatively small, that you can pretty much meet all the speakers. And we ask the speakers, when we ask them if they want to come, we basically say, we want you to do a talk that's actionable. We want you to come for all three nights. And we want you to come to the events, because we don't just want to see you speak. Like, we want you to interact and help the attendees. And so we're trying to get speakers who are interested in doing that. And so far, we've had good luck doing that. And I'd definitely be keeping that up next year, because obviously it's one of the kind of the top three things folks mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
How about the negatives? You want to run through them?
Sure. So the first one that we got back, which I was a little bit surprised about, was that the Hard Rock Hotel was not very well received. A lot of people said that it was too loud and it was really hard to talk to people during some of the hangout sessions. And one of the things that I noticed was that Monday night was by far the easiest night to talk to people, and that was across the street at someplace else where it was kind of a private gathering.
Yep. No, I was surprised by that too, but it makes sense. And enough people said it. There was a big chunk of people who basically said the Hard Rock is too loud. It was too hard to hang out. One person said it felt like spring break. Now, there was actually a reality TV show being filmed there. It was an MTV show that neither you or I knew about. And so like Saturday and Sunday, and even into like Monday morning, there were just a bunch of kind of spring breakers. And I was actually trying to get out to the pool, and the guy was basically like, uh-uh. Like, he gave me the, you're not dressed for the pool, because I was in jeans. But I think what he really meant was, you're too damn old to be out in the pool right now. I think we need to think about next year, looking at a different hotel.
Well, if you think about it in terms of scheduling, though, this is the second year in a row where we've had the conference and something else was going on that we just didn't necessarily know about. And not that we have any control about it. I mean, I think last year we had MicroConf in the middle of Apple's developer conference.
Yeah, and realistically, if that wasn't there, I do think it would have been a different scene. It would have been quieter. But bottom line is, yeah, next year we'll at least evaluate other options and see if we can, potentially swing another hotel.
Yeah, definitely. I really did like the second night over at Rumor across the street.
Yep.
That was put on by the guys over at WildBit, which is really cool of them to do that. So definitely thanks to you guys for helping us to put that on and putting all that stuff together. I think I got a lot of great feedback from that as well.
We got other positive and negative feedback. These were just kind of the most popular. I was surprised to see several comments. People were saying they were disappointed with the Tuesday evening gathering, that it wasn't in a penthouse suite. Because last year we had just a total last minute. We hadn't organized anything for Tuesday night. And Andrew Warner happened to have this big suite that we had given him. And we just all went up there and, bought some beer and some snacks and hung out. And it was really cool. But this year we tried to do that. You and I tried to get the penthouse suite, but it would only hold 75 people. And so we couldn't do it because we would have had, you know, not been able to have everybody up there. So instead we just went to a bar and slapped down the credit card for a few hours. And I thought it was fine, but we got enough feedback that it wasn't. Some people said it felt not organized, and other people said it was too loud. And then other people specifically mentioned, oh, I had heard there was a, you know, a kind of a penthouse suite thing last year and was bummed that didn't happen again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll definitely have to try and find some place that has a penthouse or do something else different, I think, next year. But, you know, it's good feedback.
It's always good to hear. So we'll keep going through that. Looking forward to next year, assuming I can convince you to do it again. Anything else on your radar for the week before we dive into some listener questions?
Yeah, I did have that survey that I put together for Audit Shark because I talked last week about possibly redirecting it, and I talked to some people at MicroConf about it. So I put out this survey. You just used WooFoo for it and put together a short survey. I think I was 7 or 8 different questions. I really like using WooFoo for this because it tells you like your conversion rates for the people who come and just look at the survey versus the people who actually go through and fill everything out. And it lets you know like all the percentages, page views, all that kind of stuff for it. Really, really helpful. And I basically asked people, I kind of explained what the problem was, having a third party look over your shoulder at your server to make sure that it was configured securely and you weren't accidentally doing things that you shouldn't be, that some script kiddie out there is going to end up hacking into your server over. And I got a lot of great feedback from. I got about 20 responses. And of those 20, there was only one who said they wouldn't pay for it. And collectively, there was a couple thousand dollars worth of, I don't want to call them commitments because I wouldn't quite call them a commitment, but you know, people said that they were collectively willing to pay a couple thousand dollars for it. So I definitely feel like I'm right on the right track with that. And I just kind of need to flesh out, you know, exactly how that offering is going to shape up and do a little bit more market development on it and build my list a little bit more. I think there was only one person who said that I couldn't add them to the launch list as well.
Very cool. So that shows you're heading in the right direction. Are you able to, you called it like website security audit software or something. Are you going to go into more of a description with them of what it would do, or did you already at the top of the survey?
So the basic question that I asked was, are you concerned about the security of your web servers? And then under that, I said, I can help. And then my problem description was, this survey is intended for people who administer their own web server. If you have trouble sleeping at night because you aren't a security expert and are constantly wondering if something might be wrong that you simply haven't discovered yet, please help us to help you by answering some simple questions. And then I just gave a brief about my prospective solution and just said, AudioShark is a cross-platform, cloud-based security product designed to read configuration data from a computer. By analyzing configuration settings and aggregating metrics across servers, AuditShark can tell you where and why you may be vulnerable to malicious attacks on your servers. Using anonymous aggregate metrics, it can rank your security profile in relation to other servers with similar configurations. In a nutshell, AuditShark acts as another set of eyes on your servers to help keep them from being compromised because of seemingly innocuous misconfigurations.
Got it. So it sounds like you went into a pretty good description of kind of the solution that you're proposing for their problem.
Mm-hmm.
So how many emails did you send out, and what was the response rate?
I actually didn't send out any emails. So what I did was I posted this as a link to the show notes for last week. And okay. So we're recording this on Thursday. I put this out there on Tuesday at around 9 a.m. So it's about 48 hours later, and I've gotten, I think, 20 different responses from people, 21. And 461 page views, a 4.6% conversion rate. It gives you an average time for submission, but it's wrong. So somebody left their browser open for like 5 or 6 hours. So that really skewed a lot of the results. But the first day that it was open, the average response time was about 5.2 minutes. So people spent some fairly significant time looking at it and reading it. I would suspect that they read the entire description and kind of really understood what it was that they were contributing information for. Pretty much everything came through either my RSS feed on my blog or through the link from the show notes. I think that the vast majority of it was from my blog, to be perfectly honest. I also put some out there on Twitter in the referrers for this. It doesn't really seem like there was a lot of activity there. I know it got retweeted several times, but I don't see anything coming in here from Twitter at all. And it may just be that it's not displaying it because the traffic
showing up is direct. Because like I use TweetDeck, and so that'll show up as direct traffic as an example. It won't show twitter.com as a referrer. T.co is the referrer.
I see T.co. Sure. There's only one. What I don't like is that it doesn't show me all of the traffic that came. All it shows me is the people who actually completed it.
Got it. Okay.
Which is kind of annoying, but you know, it'd be nice to see how many of those 430 people or whatever came from Twitter.
Totally cool. Well, so what's your next step then? Are you going to be contacting those folks to find out more about what they need?
Yeah. So I'm going to start sending, because there's only about 20 of them, I'm going to go back and I'm going to start having individual conversations with them and kind of clarify exactly what it is that my intentions are and how it would work. And one of the things I asked, which I thought was important, was, says, what are the two primary concerns you would have about this type of service? And I got a lot of good feedback about people saying, oh, well, I wouldn't sign up because of this or that. And there are things that could be easily addressed with like an FAQ or something along those lines. It was just because I didn't give them enough information. But it seemed to me like because they have a real problem, they're willing to make, I'll say, certain concessions about, you know, signing up for a service that's actually going to let them resolve that problem.
Sure. No, that's great, because that's the way to get started with your kind of your marketing copy, right? Getting in the minds of your prospects and figuring out what that conversation is. That exact question you asked is perfect for getting those bullet points on your homepage and getting your calls to action in place to kind of resolve those issues, those objections that they have early on. Because otherwise, you know, when you're doing in-person sales, you know, it's like people have objections and you address them, you know, assuming your product handles what they want it to do. Like, you can always just say that objection is essentially not valid. You say it very tactfully, but it's harder to do that on the web unless you know the objections in advance and you've asked that. So nice work.
And the other thing I did was I consciously used the title for this, you know, concerned about the security of your web servers, from a conversation I had with somebody at MicroConf who, you know, had said, you know, I would pay for this. And I asked why. And he said, he's like, I can't sleep at night sometimes. It's like, I wonder if there's something wrong. It's like, I've got a ton of people who are using that server, and what happens if it goes down? And he's basically said he'd have a very serious problem on his hands just if the server went down, not even if it was hacked, but just if the server goes down, because there's so many people. I think he said he had like thousands and thousands of accounts on there. I was just basically lifting his terminology to kind of put at the top of this, and it seems like it worked out.
Cool. Any other things before we dive into questions?
Based on some of this stuff, I'm going to, you know, I've already got a logo that's in the works, and I'm doing a scope of work for a contractor to build up a new Audit Shark sales website for me. I'm going to supply all the content and everything, but I need some CSS templates and stuff. But, you know, those will be coming up over the next week or two, and we'll just go from there.
Sounds cool. All right. Well, we have a couple questions queued up. Let's see how many we get through. The first one is about mailing lists versus a Facebook page. And it's from Brendan Duncan. And it says, I followed some of your advice and started marketing my web app before it's finished. On my site at 3dvirtualtabletop.com, and that's the number 3, the letter D, virtualtabletop.com. I've been collecting email addresses with MailChimp, but I also have a Facebook page. It occurs to me that a Facebook fan is more valuable than an email address because their interest is public, and word of my app could spread socially or at least pop up higher in search results, especially with Google+. Given that my app is consumer-focused, I'm thinking about replacing the email sign-up form with a button to like my app on Facebook. What are your thoughts on this? I love this app. It's a D&D, a Dungeons & Dragons virtual tabletop that runs, it looks like, on an iPad, or maybe it's an Android tablet. And I haven't played D&D since high school, but man, I would have loved this thing. It's such a cool demo. I really like the video.
So I think he makes a couple of different points. And the first one is that he's been collecting email addresses with MailChimp. And then he also has the Facebook page. And his thought process is that, you know, the Facebook fan page is going to be more valuable than an email address because their interest is public. I think that the problem with that thinking is that because you haven't launched yet, I think you're going to have a very hard time getting any of those Facebook like. I think what you need to do is stick with collecting email addresses through MailChimp. And then once you've actually launched, then switch over to using the Facebook page or in trying to gather Facebook likes. Because I think that those initial conversations that you have with people collecting those email addresses is going to be a lot more important to help you target your marketing efforts and find out what it is that people like about the product and what problem they're really trying to solve. And then using those conversations to basically fill out the marketing collateral on your website. And then using those Facebook likes to kind of spread the word and spread the message. Because once you've launched, then those email addresses are probably a lot less valuable to you than the Facebook likes. But I think that there's definitely a transition period there where, you know, you use the MailChimp email addresses first, and then you transition over to the Facebook page later.
Yeah, I'm on the same page. I do not think removing your email signup form is a good idea at all. And I disagree with the notion that a Facebook fan is more valuable than an email address just because they're public. Your goal right now is to get a list of people who are interested, whom you can contact at a later date when you launch. You want to get as many stacked together in some form that you can message where they will actually respond. So you can think about this like you could start, in theory, you could start a Twitter account, and that call to action on your landing page could be follow me on Twitter. The reason you don't do that is because A, a lot of consumers aren't on Twitter, and B, the conversion rate, the click-throughs from Twitter are terrible. The best conversion rates I've seen by far are with email. Everyone has email, and people just, they tend to read it, and they tend to click through. If you could somehow build a fan page, get people to like it, and then you could message them, which I'm pretty sure is not actually possible. It was possible at one point, but Facebook discontinued this, it looks like in 2011. And even when you could do it, it went into a separate inbox, and it often did not email people about it. So it really was this kind of no man's land. And from what I've read about this, there's really low conversion rates on this stuff. So number one, I think you need to stick with email. But I think there's an in-between here. I think what I would do, if since you are consumer facing, is have your email signup form, and when they enter the email, they click submit, they arrive at a landing page that says, thanks for submitting, check your email, you know, click on a link to be on the list. And since you've obviously like our app, why don't you now click this Facebook like button and potentially a retweet button? And so then it's a sequential thing. So you're not asking them to do one or the other, but you're going to get, you know, everyone who submits an email through is then going to be, you know, fairly likely to then click the Facebook like thing and spread it from there. Because you got to think about it. If you just get a bunch of likes on this page and yeah, it quote unquote goes viral and you get thousands of people to come to this page from Facebook, what then? What's the end goal? You still need to sell them something, or you need to have their email so you can sell them this app later. So thanks, Brendan, for your question, and I hope that helps. Our next question is from Brian Donahue at pigeonmoon.com. He says, hey guys, I'm curious what techniques, tips, or tricks you have to share about how you balance your programmer's mind with your business mind in your daily work. I often find myself torn between what seems like opposite ends of a spectrum, the desire to be and think like an entrepreneur and focus on business goals and shipping good enough software, and the desire to write great code, learn new technologies, and generally scratch the geek itch. I'm curious if you have any good tips or guidelines about how to deal with this. I know that you both hire freelance developers to work on your stuff. I'd like to hear more about how that went initially and how you were able to let go of your need to rule the code. You both seem like accomplished developers. I feel like I would be constantly fighting the feeling, true or not, that I could build it better. Love the podcast. He says, love, love, love. That's 3X, the podcast. Thanks for doing it. Brian, what do you think, sir?
No, I don't have any good tips.
You don't?
No,
it's
actually
a struggle, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the problem. And I think that each person has to approach it a little bit differently. The way I do it is I think about it as engineering a business, not necessarily engineering a product. And I think that helps me. And it may help you, it may not. But I think that if you think of it in those terms, you're still building something, and in that sense, you're trying to make that the best that you can. It's not necessarily your job to make the code the best. But what you can do is you can put guidelines and frameworks in place. I guess it will help that to grow out the way that you want it to. So one of the topics of my talk at MicroConf, for example, is building processes and systems and putting them in place to help you build out your business. And I don't see that as being any different. You put these rules in place for how you want the code checked in, how you want it commented, what tools to use, all the different steps that your code needs to go through. And essentially, that's your quality control system. And if somebody is doing something wrong or you don't like what they're doing, you need to do one of two things. Either one, you replace them, and that replacement could be with yourself, but the reality is it shouldn't be. If you've already outsourcing the code, then if you need to find somebody else to do it, don't replace that person with yourself, because you can do it better. The fact is, you will always be doing that code better. What your talents are probably better used at is engineering the business and finding somebody to fill that role for you. I'd say that's probably my best recommendation, is to kind of step back a little bit and think of it from a little bit higher level than you probably are. I mean, because when you start thinking about code, you're thinking ones and zeros and all the things that need to go into that. And you need to think a little bit more abstract. You need to think more like an architect. And you're becoming a business architect as opposed to a product architect.
Yeah, I think it comes down to a couple things. I think it comes down to knowing yourself, knowing what you're good at, knowing what will make you happy and what you'll enjoy, and knowing kind of where you want to go, like what your goals are. And I think that if you really like to code and you really like to get in and learn new things and just write scrappy code and optimize it and architect it and do all that stuff, I think you need to seriously think about building a product that doesn't sell, like an open source project or something like that. Because if you really want to optimize your fun and learning, you're absolutely going to need to go do something where the business part side of it is not the goal. But if you say to that, well, I don't want to waste a bunch of my time because I don't like my job and I want to quit my job, then you need, in my opinion, you need to optimize for making money from your product. And in order to do that, you have to start letting go of some of this stuff, period. I don't know of any software entrepreneur, micro ISV or otherwise, who still codes absolutely as much as they want all the time and only works on interesting things and doesn't hire it out. And, you know, was able to quit their job and live on this. Maybe if you moved overseas and it was, you know, a lot cheaper or something, you could do it on $1,000 or $2,000 a month. If you want to build, you know, a substantial full-time income, you have to make some sacrifices for that goal. And I'm not saying you have to give up code altogether. In the past 6 months, I've probably averaged 20 hours of coding a week. And I've loved it. Like when I get in the zone, I've absolutely loved it. It's brought me back to the days when I used to code, 40, 50 hours a week every week. At the same time, I have enjoyed mixing it up and doing the business goals. It's like you said, having the opposite ends of the spectrum existing at both times, where you're bouncing from business stuff and bouncing back to the code. Now, the one difference is that since I'm able to outsource code, I'm outsourcing the code that I don't want to work on, and I'm keeping the stuff that is really interesting and that will teach me things, and I'm doing it myself. So that's where I think the trade-off comes, is once you learn to outsource, then you do give people the stuff that is not as interesting or that you've done before that's not going to teach you. You stick to the interesting things. And then if you're naturally feeling like you're going to need to do all the coding or you're going to be gravitating towards that, I think that if you fight that urge, you need to really fight it. You need to always swing toward the other side of the pendulum if you know that that's your natural tendency, is to outsource more than you think you need to and to put more importance on spending time on the marketing and finding customers for your product. I think Mike is right. I think of it as engineering a business, engineering a marketing process, engineering support processes, and even, you know, engineering outsourcing to developers. There really are engineering elements in that. And I believe that you can probably find happiness in both of them. And like I said, it comes back to knowing yourself and knowing, like, really deep down what your absolute goals are. So I hope that helps. All right. Question number 3 is from Christoph. He says, "Hi, Mike. Hi, Rob. I've got a question regarding pre-launch mailing lists that I didn't find answered in the podcast. You've been talking about the importance of building a pre-launch mailing list, and I figure the more the merrier. But is there a minimum viable mailing list size one should have before launching the product? For the sake of a concrete example, assume that you only collected email addresses after potential customers clicked on the sign-up link on your SaaS application's website. Regards, Christoph." And then he says, "P.S., your podcast rocks. Listening to it is often the only reason I get off my lazy ass and go for a run." Well, thanks for that. Okay, so I do have a couple thoughts. So the conversion rates that I've typically seen from launch lists range dramatically. I've had launches go at 20% of the mailing list size, meaning 20% convert into people who buy. I've had it as high with my book. It was topped out at about 50% by the time the launch was all done. But that's atypical. I have seen products launch and get around a 5% conversion rate. And it all depends on how well you've laid the groundwork, how close your product is to really meeting the needs of that market, how ready they are to buy, you know, the timing. I mean, there's a lot of elements, how good your marketing is, what phase the product is in, all kinds of stuff. So with that said, I've seen mailing lists from, you know, in the 50, 60 range up into the several thousand ranges. And it really is definitely the more the merrier, because it's all just, you know, a game of numbers at that point. As long as the list is targeted, you definitely want to build it up as large as possible. I think if you have less than a few hundred on your mailing list, that you're going to have a tough product launch. Typically, I tell people when you hit 500, start feeling comfortable. And that's just, again, a vague rule of thumb, because even at 5%, that's only 25 customers on your first day. And that's, you know, not like the best launch ever. But if you can get it up into the 10 to 15%, obviously that really gets you off to a good start. Now, in terms of having collecting email addresses after potential customers click on their sign-up link on your SaaS app's website, to me, that's just a testing phase, right? You do that, you build the SaaS app marketing website, and then you put the sign-up form, and you're trying to validate it. It's more about conversion rates from people hitting the homepage, going all the way through to the buy phase, and you're trying to figure out what that conversion rate is. And you know, if you can get that up into the 2, 3, 4%, then it seems relatively viable, and you can drive enough traffic to that website using, you know, whatever methods available to you, then you're starting to think, okay, I actually might be able to build a viable product out of there. Once I decided I was able to build a viable product, I would then switch it over and probably go back to the landing page approach, because at that point, all you're doing is trying to optimize for email addresses. You're just trying to get the most possible before you launch.
I think there's a couple of things that stick out to me. And one was, as you said, when you're trying to validate people who are coming to your mailing list and they're clicking on the sign-up link. I think that, just to clarify, he explicitly said sign-up link on your SaaS application's website. It's not clear whether he means that there's pricing before the sign-up page, but you really need to have the pricing before that, because them clicking on sign up, a lot of times they're doing it just because they want to see the price. So that helps to make sure that the people who are getting onto the list are targeted. And that's the other point that I wanted to bring up, was how well targeted that mailing list actually is. I think that for a launch to be, I guess, worth it, you either have to think in terms of dollar amounts or number of signups that you want to get, and then back up from there and kind of reverse engineer the math behind it to say, okay, well, if I'm going to convert 15% of these people and I want, I don't know, $500 a month from my launch, then that means that, you know, of those 15% that signed up, there's going to be another 85% that didn't. So kind of do the math on that to figure out what that number is actually going to come out to be. And it's obviously going to be dependent upon your price point and lots of other things. You need to figure out what sort of a number you feel comfortable with. And from there, you know, try and make sure that your mailing list is targeted. I mean, and the only way you'll know that is by talking to those people who are going onto your mailing list. I wouldn't say that there's a minimum size. I think that it has a lot to do with what your expectations for that launch are going to be.
All right. And for our last question, we have one from David Yang. And he says, my request for you guys is that I would love to hear more about numbers. What can developers who get into this type of micropreneurship expect in terms of income? I know that the answer varies widely, but would love to hear your two experiences with various types of sites, apps, and projects. Pat Flynn has a really cool income progress report, and Mixergy's podcast always have lots of financial data. I think it helps to paint a real picture that in addition to the lifestyle upgrades you can accomplish, the outcomes could be even better than being an employee at a very successful startup. Keep up the great work, and I'm really bummed I missed the first MicroConf. Hope to make it next year. Regards, David.
I think it's a little hard to generalize on this type of question. You know, I mean, I could talk about numbers that I've seen from my businesses and things that I'm working on. I don't know how comfortable Rob feels about kind of sharing those numbers, but obviously you're already seeing some from Pat Flynn and from the things that you see on Mixergy. I mean, one of the things that I talked about at MicroConf, I actually showed some of my revenue numbers. So for last year, my total revenue was about, I think it was $212,000. And then once you start deducting for things that were various business expenses like healthcare and dental and taxes and insurance and all kinds of other things, travel expenses, that sort of stuff, I think it dropped it down to an income of, I want to say, $172,000. So it's about $40,000 in expenses. So that's an overhead of about, say, 25%.
Now that includes consulting income.
Yes, it does. It does.
That, just to clarify, because I don't know if David means only from product income. I mean, that's why this question is hard to answer, is that I know people who are making $500 a month at it, right, and just want to make a car payment. And then we know people who literally make $30,000 a month who are solo operators. So there's a huge range.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's part of what makes it so difficult to answer, because, you know, the question itself is, what can developers who get into this type of micropreneurship expect in terms of income? And
I think that's the wrong, I don't think that's the right question to even ask.
I don't think so either. So I think you're right. I mean, that really is the wrong type of question to ask. I mean, it really depends on what your goals are and what you want to do. I don't have any doubts that it's possible to put together a business where you're making six, or, you know, obviously six figures is possible. Lots of people are doing it. But in terms of putting together a business that makes seven figures and it's just you, I think that's possible. I wouldn't say that it's common or probable. I think that it's definitely within the realm of possibility to put together a solo business where you're making $200,000-$400,000 a year. I think once you start going beyond that point, upwards of $400,000 or $500,000 a year, you almost have to bring on employees, because unless you've got a lot of processes and automation built in and you're outsourcing a lot of different things, I think it's going to be very difficult to sustain that a business of that level without bringing on additional help that's more full-time help. But in terms of the question itself, I just don't think that that's the right question to ask. You know, what can you expect? That's so dependent upon what product you're doing, or what products, what niches you're serving, you know, what your product does, price point, all those different things factor into it. So expectations, you may be expecting $20 million a month, and that's just not realistic.
Yeah, I think the answer to the question is it's going to involve, no matter what comes back, it's going to involve a ton of hard work. It's going to involve a ton of skill, a ton of learning, and a little bit of luck. And so you can expect that you're going to have to put a ton of all of those things in, and that you're likely to succeed if you do all those things and you have them all in place. It's kind of hard because some, you know, you can say micropreneur, but like I see some micropreneurs that are literally shooting for like $1,000 a month, and they kind of want to keep their main job and just do it. And then other micropreneurs who are shooting for $20,000 a month. And that's just a totally different goal set, right? I think that if your goal is to make as much money as possible, then you need to optimize your entire process for that. And you need to be able and willing to just work like crazy and work towards this, you know, crazy goal. But I think a big part of the micropreneurship is that it's not optimizing for that in general. You could do it, but most people I know are optimizing for the freedom, the location independence, the lifestyle upgrades. And so I would never pitch it as your outcome, your financial outcome could be better than being an employee at a very successful startup. I don't even think that's the goal. I think if that's your goal, then you should go be an employee at a very successful startup. I think your odds are probably better of going out there and doing that than trying to make, like Mike said, seven figures a year by staying solo. I think the odds of that are tremendously small. But at the same time, I actually think the odds of getting a successful micropreneur business or getting a successful business that can support you off the ground and running is much, much higher than going out and hitting the startup lottery and working the years and moving to the Silicon Valley or Boston or New York, one of these startup hubs, and putting in the time and putting in the years and basically gambling and assuming that you're gonna cash out on stock options, whether you're the founder or not. So it's kind of the two ends, right? If you're looking at the lifestyle aspects of it, then I absolutely think that you have a better chance with micropreneurship. And if you're looking at the other end of it and want to make a big slam bang in terms of money, then I think you need to go to the other end. The last thing I'll say is it does at some point come down to some semantics, because Mike said, you know, if you're going to try to grow a business into the seven figures, then you're going to need to hire employees. Now, what is an employee and what is part-time help and what is a virtual assistant and what is a developer that just works for you on Odesk? At this point, I've talked about it before, I have between 8 and 10 people who work for me a few hours a month at least on Odesk. So I consider myself still independent because I'm not having to manage, you know, 401ks and provide like all kinds of employee leadership and mentoring and a career path and that kind of stuff. And yet I do have to manage people. And so if your goal is to truly be a solo operator, then you have some limitations. If your goal is to be somewhere in the middle, which I'm considering myself at this point, I am solo. No one reports to me. I don't, you know, get phone calls with people ask for management advice or whatever. But that's kind of a middle ground. And then on the other end, there's people who are actually hiring and building up companies. And that's, like Mike said, going to be the way to grow it.
You know, when I had said getting up to 500,000, 600,000 or so and going beyond that, I mean, you really need help. You know, I was thinking more employees than, you know, outsourced through Odesk or something like that. But I mean, that's certainly another option. The problem with that, I think, is that you definitely need to have your processes nailed down pretty tight if you're going to be outsourcing it versus having somebody who lives nearby who, you know, just managing remotely who you are employing full time and they're depending on it as their sole source of income.
Yep. It's a different ball game. Yeah, there are examples of people who are, you know, talking about their income. I know Amy Hoy mentioned, I think she makes, what, $330,000 from Freckle, or that's the run rate right now. And I think they make another $300,000 from other stuff. I mean, it's easy enough to find people talking about their incomes. The problem is it's kind of, one, it's survivor bias, and two, they just tend to be outliers. And it's like 5 years later, you know, after all this stuff, someone is making X amount, but I'm not sure really how realistic that is for someone, you know, a year out of the gate. And I couldn't even guess at what the odds of that kind of thing are going to be of hitting it at that level.
Yeah. I mean, the survivor bias definitely skews that metric because you don't see all the people who tried and or are doing it now, but they're only making a couple hundred dollars a month. I mean, those people are generally not putting all those numbers out there because they don't feel like they're impressive or they're embarrassed by them. I started sharing my numbers at MicroConf just because I want to start getting people to have those discussions, because I think that if you have a company that's 5 or 10 employees and you say, oh, well, you know, my 10-person company made, you know, $1.5 million last year, that's a lot different than saying I have a single person company and, you know, I made X last year or 150,000. It's the same number per employee, but it's different when you're saying I made this and, you know, I was doing everything on my own versus my company made $1.5 million. And I think that having those discussions is definitely important because I don't think that people talk about them enough. And I didn't go into a lot of details about why I shared my numbers at MicroConf, but I mean, that's basically it. I think that those discussions need to be had amongst people. And I think that it helps people to just kind of judge, not just necessarily where they're at, but to help kind of answer these types of questions of, you know, what can I expect? What is realistic? And I think that that's the one thing that's not in either of our responses yet, is that your expectations can be wildly out of touch with what reality is and what is possible. And because you don't know what anyone else's numbers are, you might have this idea in your head that, oh, I can build a, you know, $750,000 a year business and, you know, everything will be great. But if you start looking around and you start seeing that the people who are doing that have teams of people under them, you're going to start realizing, hey, that's not really realistic. That's kind of, you know, why I started sharing those numbers, because I think that people need a bit of a reality check sometimes. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I understand where you're coming from about the point of survivor bias and, you know, the numbers get skewed and you've got these people who've been doing it for 3, 4, 5, 10 years. I mean, I've been on my own for 7 years at this point. So that 7-year number should definitely factor into what I'm talking about here. But, you know, it takes a while to get there. It's not something that's something you can do overnight or that most people can do overnight.
I will say that I know a lot, I mean, dozens of basically solo software / web / mobile founders who are making full-time incomes, you know, whatever that means. And for some people, full-time income is $4,000 or $5,000 a month. And for others, they had to get to 100K before they could quit their job. I know a lot of folks doing that. So it's definitely becoming, you know, I feel like it's becoming more and more viable over the years, which is a good thing for everybody.
Yeah. And I mean, that full-time income is definitely the key piece of that whole question, I think. I mean, it's not about the dollar amount. It's about whether or not you can make a full-time living doing it. And I think that's the big piece of it that's not asked and we haven't really talked a lot about. It's just, you know, can you do this on your own and not be employed by some mega corporation someplace? And the answer to that is absolutely yes, you can. And will you have to make some sacrifices about where you live or, you know, the type of house that you have or the type of car that you drive? Maybe, you know, that's very possible. But, you know, once you start getting into it and you start finding that you have 20, 30, 40, 50 hours a week extra that you didn't have before to sink into your business, I think that things change very quickly.
The cool part is you're able to decide that for yourself, right? If you decide that having that free time, or not even free time, but just time to invest in your business and enjoy what you're doing is more valuable to you than that second car or than, you know, the neighborhood that you live in, then at that point, you'll make the sacrifice and basically take the step down, or you'll work a little harder for the next 6 months and keep growing the business until it hits the point where it really does support you at the level you're at. If you have a question or comment, call it into our voicemail number at 888-801-9690, or you can email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.